All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Michael Robert Cadence. I'm continuing the series that I've been doing on the idea of progress, how we conceptualize it, define it, and how we how philosophy, I should say, as a field, has developed and created different ideas of progress throughout history, and how those might apply to our modern notions of progress. We started out by looking at the philosophical problems or difficulties with creating a view of progress, which has basically become synonymous on this show as an ideal that describes how the world should be, an ideal that you think about as a better world or as an ideal world. To think about it another way, an ideal or good society. Some people might think this has to do with utopian thought, and while there are some perhaps correlations, that's not the focus of our investigations here. Last week we ended looking at ideas from Enlightenment philosophy, and today we are moving into 19th century. Now, these 19th century views are somewhat controversial. They have been criticized and analyzed a lot in modern times, and we'll be doing that somewhat on this show, but mostly on the next show, which has we're going through a document that and an article that describes the different sections of progress throughout history, and the next section of the article has specific kind of professional opinions on criticisms of the 19th century. So understand that you're not getting a complete picture just by looking at this episode, which just describes the views and not the criticisms of these views. Okay, so let's jump into it. The 19th century writers on progress took up and elaborated the notion that conflict is an essential part of progressive narrative. W.F. Hegel, 1770 to 1831, is an example of such a writer. Hegel does not give a straightforward account of human progress. He puts a version of universal history as the center of his metaphysics, from which a narrative of progress can be derived. According to Hegel, the world as a whole is in the process of development through conflict. Part of the world's development is the self-realization of its spiritual aspect, known simply as Geist, or spirit. The freedom of spirit is achieved through the achievement of free social institutions and free human beings. So we look to human history to understand the realization of spirit. Conversely, we recognize the self-realization of spirit, an entity not reducible to humanity, is the true meaning of human history. There are several claims there which modern philosophers might find issue with. The idea that conflict is kind of the mechanism of human progress, the idea that the true meaning of human history is the realization of spirit. There are definitely some ideas here which we could have some problems with, but I think as we'll go on, it's also interesting to think about how our modern notions of progress might have inherited some things from Hegel's philosophy.
The idea of conflict is itself a whole topic of debate. I have my own idea about this, that it isn't the conflict per se that leads to progress, but its ability to resolve conflict through means other than war. So that would be progress. That would be progress to be able to resolve conflict, because after all, conflict comes from competing strategies to meet needs. So if we start with the premise that humans have needs and humans are going about trying to meet their needs and they employ strategies to meet their needs, and sometimes strategies conflict with other people's strategies to meet their needs, then that produces what we're calling conflict. Because your strategy to meet your need is interfering with my strategy to meet my need, and that creates conflict between us. I would agree with the idea that conflict produces or is the catalyst for progress, but only to the extent that you and I have the ability to resolve the conflict or to find ways to meet both of our needs without being in perpetual warfare or perpetual stalemate around that. So I would agree to some extent that conflict is part of the equation when it comes to progress, but as I said, only to the extent that we learn to resolve it.
And I think we'll see that the juxtaposition that you're putting forth there, that you would like conflict to be resolved, and if you can resolve a conflict without war or without violence, then this is potentially good, potentially progress. But the violence and war is not something that we see as part of our vision or our ideal of progress in the modern day. The state is crucial to Hegel's philosophy of history. For Hegel, the state is the march of God, spirit. In this case, the word God in Hegel's philosophy just means spirit, the same word as Geist, as previously indicated in the world. At any point in time, a state or group of states represent the highest point achieved by humanity thus far. Hegel thinks that at the time of his writing, the states of Western Europe play this role. In The Philosophy of Right, he argues that these states, however imperfectly, combine individual freedom with social unity into one enduring whole. The political constitution of the society he describes is a constitutional monarchy. He approximates the never adopted constitution the Prussian reformers drew up. It approximates, so his ideas approximate the ideas developed in the never adopted constitution that Prussian reformers drew up in 1819. So Prussia, for those not aware in our audience, was a German province. And when Germany was unified into one country, the King of Prussia became the King of Germany. I am not an expert on German history, but that's kind of the tip of the iceberg there. But it's also worth noting that this constitution that his ideas, this article says, are approximated to was never adopted in Germany. History, according to Hegel's metaphysical account, is driven by ideological development. Ideological and therefore historical change occurs when a new idea is nurtured in the environment of the old one and eventually overtakes it. Thus, development necessarily involves periods of conflict when the old and new ideas clash. A second account of change is contained in the master-slave dialectic of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. Certain forms of social hierarchy are intrinsically unstable. The human desire for recognition drives social development, which consists of repeated struggles for recognition until it reaches the liberal solution. In the liberal state, slaves and masters are abolished and all recognize all as free and equal. This arrangement lacks the contradictions inherent in previous social forms. According to Hegel, conflict occurs within and between states. But world historical individuals, like Napoleon Bonaparte, also have a key part to play in driving history forward. These great men are often motivated by narrow personal goals. Hegel paints a disturbing picture of the historical tendency of great men to trample on and use ordinary ones, but he thinks great men are ultimately tools as well of spirit and its self-realization. Hegel's justification of war and destruction in the name of progress reflect his overall philosophy. He holds that we can be reconciled to negative elements by seeing their place within a larger pattern. In The Phenomenology of Spirit, he summarizes his thesis in the following slogan: the true is the whole. Finally, in contrast to Kant, Hegel thinks that war is more than an engine of progress. Hegel argues that without war, individuals in liberal societies become self-absorbed and weak, unwilling to work for the common good. There is, moreover, no outlet for human aggression. For these reasons, war is ineliminable. It will be a feature even of the rational system of states that mark the end of historical development. I have to admit, I am not very happy with this idea of progress. I definitely don't like the way that it's conceptualized, but I can definitely see where we might have adapted some of these ideas towards modern notions of progress. The idea of a liberal state that recognizes all as free and equal, I can see that part as something that we still hold to. But I think the overall idea that you're always going to have a conflict between old and new, and that conflict must be a feature of all systems in the future, I think that's very interesting. I think that even today we still think about how to resolve conflicts between old ideas and new ideas, and that there is conflict there. But I wouldn't say that that necessitates the warlike ideas that he describes here. I would say I'm a little offended by the presupposition that war is necessary for human progress. I don't think that that is at all the case. Just as a reminder, we are reading these ideas and thinking about them and critiquing them and exploring them, but we do not support Hegel's ideas. We're just exploring them from the philosophical perspective.
I have a caution, one that I've raised before, which is we have to be careful about generalizing to all of humanity from what European men find to be true, or what they theorize. So there's several biases there. There's European, there's male, there's patriarchal. So we have to be careful. And maybe what Hegel is describing is this theory about how European men operate with each other. Notice how even though the word man was used in the text you read from. So I think there's a gender bias here, which is, of course, one of the complaints about Western philosophy. Anyway, traditional Western philosophy. So I can't help but think that this is a particular subset of humanity, right? European men, in this case in the 19th century, theorizing as though they are describing all of humanity, right? All of humanity, and they're not. And we don't know that other cultures, or that females, or that a hypothetical matriarchal society would operate in the same way, or that the same theories, even to the extent they're true in Western male society, would hold, that they would hold in other cultures. Just an example of that, not in the human race, but in the bonobo and versus chimpanzees. So if you look at chimpanzees versus bonobos, chimpanzees are very warlike. They're constantly involved in conflict, and it's a patriarchal system. But bonobo apes, who are often considered to be the closest living primates to humans, have a matriarchal society, matriarchal structure, and they have much, much less conflict. And actually, even more importantly, when conflicts arise, they are resolved very quickly in that matriarchal culture. So it may be that that other cultures, real or imagined, right, hypothetical or real, would not operate in the same way that our philosophers, 19th century philosophers, are, or even other century philosophers, are describing. It's a very male and Western European oriented theory, and may only apply to that subset of humanity.
It is worth noting, for some historical context, that this Hegel did, of course, live in the late 18th and early 19th century, and so he wasn't part of the same philosophical movements that we are today. So we shouldn't be too harsh on some of his ideas. There is a problem sometimes that we have in history of taking our present moralities and judging other histories and cultures as if they existed in the same space that we do now. And that, I believe, idea or school of history is called presentism. So it's a very fine line to draw as a historian between understanding the context in which people operated and lived, trying to be objective, versus providing and defining who is good and bad by your own moral principles before analyzing the ideas.
But you're bringing up an interesting point, which ties in with ethics. And it brings us back to the question of, or the distinction between is and ought. And it also brings us to the question of relativism versus objectivism. So you could take the position that progress entails, among other things, the move toward the world as it ought to be. So the way that people lived, the way that societies operated, the values that were held 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, were further from the way things ought to be than we are now. If that's the case, we've made progress. So if the goalpost is a world which resembles the way things ought to be, according to a objective theory of ethics, then as we move closer and closer over the decades and over the centuries, as the human race moves, or at least the European, right, the patriarchal European culture moves closer to that goalpost, then we're making progress, and that's how we can measure progress. But that would entail an admission or a concession that we're not just relativists here. We're not saying that we cannot say that people in the 19th century, 18th century, 17th century were simply living according to what the values were at that time, and that was fine. Because then we can say that there's progress being made now, 100 years, 200 years later, because progress toward what? If in every century and if in every epoch and every era, everything's just fine and there's no gap between is and ought, then there's nowhere to go. There's no progress to be made. So I think that we can talk about progress in the sense of we're moving closer progressively, right? Incrementally closer to the way things ought to be.
Of course, that naturally brings up the question of how do we know things ought to be a certain way? How do we know what the world ought to be? Which is one of the central questions in coming up with an ideal of progress. So I think we'll leave Hegel alone for now, and we'll look at Karl Marx, a somewhat less controversial figure in history. So Karl Marx, 1818 to 1883, adopted Hegel's single factor model of historical development, but turned Hegel right side up by replacing his idealism with materialism. According to Marx, the fundamental fact about a society at a given moment is not its ideological orientation, but rather its productive forces, by which Marx means its material and technological resources. Over the long run, the productive forces determine other aspects of the society, starting with the relations of production, the informal and formal rules that define and regulate property. Marx builds on these assumptions to define capitalism and communism and to predict the former's eventual transformation into the latter. Like Hegel, Marx asserts that conflict drives historical development, but in Marx's account, conflict occurs when the productive forces outgrow the relations of production. A different class of society represents each side of the conflict. The class that benefits from the outmoded relations of production seeks to maintain them, while the losing class seeks to destroy them and replace them. For instance, capitalism emerged from feudal aristocracy, when the merchants, through revolution, rewrote their laws in their favor. Capitalism is a system in which land and labor are commodities able to be bought and sold on the free market. Marx predicts that communism will emerge from capitalism because the productive forces developed within a capitalist society will eventually make capitalist property rights unworkable. At this point, the working class or proletariat will successfully overthrow the old order. So that's a grand simplification of ideas, but necessary for our time constraints. So let's continue a bit more. Marx's philosophy of history can seem like a deterministic materialism that ignores ideas and passes no judgment on the change it describes. However, this picture is incomplete. First of all, Marx thinks that consciousness of historical trends will guide at least some of the future revolutionaries. Second, Marx clearly thinks that communism is superior to capitalism because it eliminates barriers to freedom, such as alienation and exploitation, and replaces them with a community of free producers. Marx's early writings, published after his death, show that the value of freedom was as central a concern for him as it was for Kant or Hegel. It is interesting to think about the ideal of a society where everyone is free as being the goal or ideal that these different philosophers are trying to attain. And that in that way, Hegel, Kant, and Marx might be said to have something in common. You could say that they just have different ways of getting there. Among 19th century thinkers, the French sociologist Auguste Comte, 1798 to 1857, puts relatively little emphasis on violence and struggle as a source of change. Comte actually coined the term sociology, 1853, to describe the scientific treatment of human societies and their development. Comte saw himself as giving sociology its context in addition to its name, but many of his arguments are not particularly original, including his most fundamental claim that intellectual development drives progress. His real contribution is to claim that intellectual development should be understood as change in the form of explanation employed by individuals seeking to understand the world. The form of explanation affects social life insofar as it corresponds to a way of predicting and manipulating events. It is true that this argument is implicit in the writings of earlier thinkers such as Turgot and Concordat, but unlike his predecessors, Comte works it out systematically. So some people see the change of human progress as, and taking an emphasis on that, as being understood as war and violence. Others see that as the development of, as intellectual development. So the source of progress is into intellectual development. So I would say those are mutually exclusive ideas, that it should be one or the other, although it could potentially be some combination of the two. Comte's main sociological law is that every science goes through three stages, which he terms the theological, the metaphysical, and the positive. In the theological stage, scientific explanation is governed by the assumption that natural events are caused by divinities. In turn, humans attempt to affect natural outcomes by appealing directly to the gods or God to take action. The metaphysical stage follows, in which phenomena are explained by referring to the abstract essences that entities are supposed to possess. The third phase, the positive phase, explains phenomena by formulating scientific laws and then subsuming individual phenomena under them. Humans cannot change these laws, but they can use their knowledge to predict and shape events. The positive stage is the most modest in its epistemological aspirations. Unlike the other two, it organizes appearances rather than looking beyond them. However, it is the most successful of the three stages in guiding human intervention into nature. This is no accident, since the same practical concerns that motivate scientific activity drive scientific development. For Comte, the ultimate motivation for scientific activity is practical. From science comes prevision, from prevision comes action. While Comte holds that the driving force of human progress is intellectual development, he asserts that progress itself consists in moral improvement. Comte refrains from claiming that humans are becoming subjectively happier. Instead, despite his rejection of Aristotelian metaphysics, Comte invokes a form of human flourishing akin to Aristotle's in the Nicomachean Ethics. Comte claims that human excellence is exercising the uniquely human capacity for reason. The human race is progressing because humans are becoming more rational and less emotional. In the final part of his career, Comte turned his attention to political theory. He had already rejected as metaphysical certain building blocks of the theory of liberal democracy, including popular sovereignty and liberal conscience. In System of Positive Polity, he envisions a socialist society governed by a few unelected officials who are in turn educated and advised by an elite priesthood of social scientists, guided by the principle that the temporal and spiritual powers of society should be separate. Comte emphasizes that the priests of positivism should not exercise political leadership themselves. Comte appeals the same principle to justify the exclusion of women from public life. He explains that women wield spiritual powers as mothers and wives, and their spiritual authority would be jeopardized if they were to pursue a vocation outside of the family. Now we have another set of ideas to add to our two previous thinkers of Hegel and Marx. We now add Comte. And so Comte's idea that the human race is becoming progressively more rational, and that that is the idea behind human progress, it's tempting. I think that you could certainly find several people today who would like to proclaim that people are becoming more rational, they're gaining a better ability to think, better access to education and resources, higher literacy rates worldwide. Is that progress? Increasing the human race's ability to reason and to reason well, to be less emotional?
I would question the premise that that's in fact the case empirically. Look at all the war and conflict that continues in the world now. And I'm not sure I could automatically agree with the idea that people are getting progressively more irrational. If they were, it would seems like there'd be less irrational behavior and less warfare. I mean, you know, Hobbes was not the only one to talk about how war is irrational, right? And no rational person would want to live in a state of war of all against all. And yet, if you look at the continuation of human history, it's not clear at all to me that there's been a progressive movement away from war and genocide and suffering at the hands of others and power-hungry despotic leaders looting their countries and repressing their people. I'm not sure that empirically we could say that that's on the decrease at all.
We could also say that the 20th century serves as, and several people have said this, that the First and Second World War in the 20th century reveal the flaws in these ideas, and that these ideas, thinking that humanity is progressive and or progressing and becoming more rational, were ludicrous. They were not accurate, and they led to a lot of naivete. I will remind our listeners that you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, where we're having an interesting discussion on 19th century ideas of human progress. And so far, we've covered Hegel, Marx, and Comte. And we are just starting on the idea of rationality and how that applies to ideas of human progress. Okay. And I believe you just wanted to comment on 20th century historical events and how that relates to these ideas.
Yeah, I also question the apparent opposite ends of the spectrum or opposite poles that you describe when it comes to emotions and rationality. So let me give you an example. So I think one of the features of liberal democracy that emerged in the 20th century was the growth of self-improvement, spirituality movements. A lot of people in the Western world, at least, actually found many Eastern traditions, right? Hindu and Buddhist traditions, and incorporated those into new spiritual practices, which were aimed at self-improvement, more happiness, more connection between people, all kinds of experimentation.